This week on Making Contact.
You know, the recruiter has a hard job and is always looking for a hot lead.
Stretched to supply the manpower to fight two wars, the U.S. military has stepped up efforts to recruit teenagers and young adults. Video games, social networks, and the schools themselves are all fertile soil for Pentagon recruiters.
I've spoken to students, said these recruiters keep calling me and calling me, and even their parents answer the phone and tell them, quit calling our house. I mean, it's harassment.
On this edition, guest producer Anna Sussman hosts a roundtable discussion about the new face of military recruiting and counter-recruiting efforts taking place.
Imagine yourself losing a leg. Imagine yourself losing an arm. Think about all the hard stuff that can happen before you even join.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
In the last 5 years, government spending for military recruitment has more than doubled. And today we spend over $7 billion a year to target potential recruits. This is mostly young people. Military recruiters are on TV, in video games, and at schools across America trying to entice youth into the armed services with promises of money for schools and job training. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is building a secret billion-dollar database of all eligible young recruits, complete with income level, grade point average, and ethnicity. Today, we're discussing the new face of military recruitment, the strategies employed by the government to enlist youth, and the counter-recruitment work being done nationwide by young people and their allies. I'm your host, Anna Sussman, and joining me in the Making Contact studios are Sandra Schwartz, Peace Education Coordinator at the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco, David Ledesma, Executive Director of the counter-recruitment group One Voice in San Jose, and from Bay Peace, a youth counter-recruitment group in Oakland, California, we're joined by Soti Sechao-Min, a senior at Emiliano Zapata Street Academy. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Great. Let's start by trying to get a clear picture of what military recruitment looks like for young people today. David, let's start with you. You're in the high schools every week, tabling with counter-recruitment materials.
Well, throughout the Bush administration, they pretty much had free rein to come on campus anytime they wanted to do their work. They would do tabling, offering free goodies for the kids with military branding. They would bring military vehicles and chin-up bars and different kind of like game booths to entice these students into talking to them and giving them their contact information and taking information about joining the military. So at least I'm there every week, and they're not there every week that I go, but they're on the campuses and they have free rein to come on pretty much any time they want.
And Salty, have you seen them come to your school?
When I was going to Fremont Federation High School, I would see them every day, like during my lunchtime. The recruiters would come and talk to students, or they'll be out there, like, you know, talking to students out in the back while they're having lunch. All of the information they give you is like, you know, they're trying to make it exciting for you to join the military.
I just wanted to add that the military recruiter access is really different based on where you live. So some schools see a lot of military recruiters and other schools see a lot less.
And do we see more recruiters at poorer schools? Does it break down by income level?
Yes.
Yes, it's mostly they target the school districts that are like, you know, budget cuts. That's like not having no money, and they're targeting that because like they think they can make a change, or they think they can offer, you know, money, which they really can't, you know, do what they say.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed in the 6 years I've been doing this work is in the more affluent communities, the school actually invited me to be there on the day the military recruiters were going to be there. And my table was set up right next to theirs. But in a school like that, they will very infrequently go there because most of those students in an affluent community are going to go to college. Whereas on the east side of San Jose, where I grew up, I mean, they have junior ROTC programs there. They wear military uniforms. The students wear their uniforms. So there is really a concentration of targeting lower-income minority communities.
And also rural communities. I think it's really important to realize that a lot of the recruitment comes from rural communities as well. I think it's really targeting communities where the people who live there have fewer options.
There's a difference between what young people are told about money for college and what they actually end up getting. For example, the Montgomery GI Bill provides between $45,000 and $70,000 for college after military, but on average only about $4,000 of that is actually paid out. What's going on there?
A lot of the money that is promised through the Montgomery GI Bill is based on your rank. The work that you did while you were in the military is based on your level in the military. So, you know, if you don't have high levels in any of those categories going through the military, then you're not going to get as much money as maxes out to the $45,000. So it's not like everybody gets that amount.
What we do know is that people who have served four or five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're having extreme difficulty returning to civilian life. There's a lot of PTSD, a lot of traumatic brain injury, and just a lot of suffering. And so it's really hard for these guys to go back and be on campus with a bunch of 18-year-olds. To go back to a campus and be, you know, in this sort of protected environment that's not very real world isn't very appealing to people who've, you know, been active duty for 8 years or 6 years or 4 years or whatever their contract was.
Sandra, I think a lot of those reasons you just mentioned also may speak to why only 15% of military personnel who complete their contract actually get a four-year degree.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about recruiting strategies. When a recruiter pursues someone they've identified as a potential recruit, what are some of the things they might do to enlist that person?
Military recruiters call kids at their home. I mean, send them emails. And, you know, there's been many times when I've spoken to students, said these recruiters keep calling me and calling me, and even their parents answer the phone and tell them, quit calling our house. I mean, it's harassment. And they don't give up. They're relentless with going after these students. And I think that we really need to take into consideration that they're kids. You know, they're 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids.
Salty, do you have any friends who've enlisted?
I have one family member. I guess a recruiter came up to him or something like that. It was my brother. He stays in San Bernardino. A recruiter came up to him and because he needed money. My brother needed money. And, you know, the recruiter was talking about, you know, how to ways to get money from the military. And, like, he was interested because, you know, of the money that was coming in. And, like, he didn't know what the bad side of the military. He texted me about it. Like, he said, you know, I'm going to, you know, going to go enroll, sign up for the Army tomorrow. And, you know, and I was like, I think it's a bad choice for you. So I told him everything that I knew about, you know, countering the recruitment for him not to join the military.
And what did he end up doing?
He did not join. So now he's like actually working at a high company job for like video technician and all that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the strategy of using delayed entry to sign up young people. This is when a young person can agree to join the military up to a year later, and they have an opt-out, but that's not always told to the young folks. Why is this delayed entry such a successful strategy for signing up young people into the military?
Well, I was interested in that question because, you know, it is really important for young people to know that they can change their mind. And a lot of times military recruiters really threaten them with all kinds of dire consequences if they change their mind. And that's absolutely not true. And if anybody listening to this program has any doubts about that, they should go to www.girightshotline.org. And all of the military regulations are right there for any branch of the military. You can do a number of things, including not show up. But reasons for changing your mind include other. So I was interested in the idea that this is a very successful recruitment strategy. And one of the things that I learned is in that period of time when they have signed up, but they're not, they haven't gone to boot camp yet, they do kind of practice military, you know, they go to drills. So the recruiter is making a relationship with the recruitee. And one of the things that happens is that if the recruitee gives the names, phone numbers, contact information of their friends and colleagues, and if any of those people then subsequently join the military, the enlistee actually gets a promotion. So in effect, there's this relationship that is being built between the enlistee and the recruiter, and they're potentially recruiting their friends. So, you know, the recruiter has a hard job and is always looking for a hot lead. And this young person can actually provide those hot leads.
Well, that issue of incentives is pretty interesting. Do you guys know, do recruiters get bonuses based on how many folks they sign up? Do they have quotas that they have to meet, and what happens if they don't meet those?
They have to meet their the amount that they was served to recruit. What I heard and known is some recruiters that don't make it, some really will kill themselves just for not making their quota, not making their amount that they're supposed to recruit.
There's actually been a number of articles written about the fact that recruiter suicide rates have really spiked. And it talks a lot about this stress that recruiters are under to make their quotas. If they don't make it, they get a lot of harassment. They may have to work extra hours. And they're also, in the past, recruiters were not necessarily combat veterans. But currently, I think it's 68% of the recruiters are combat veterans. So they may, also be suffering from some additional stress. And that's, I'm guessing that there's some conflict. They actually know what they're recruiting young people to do based on their experience.
There have been some pretty scary stories out there about recruiter harassment, particularly when young people change their mind during this delayed entry period. There's a story of a young woman in the Bronx who changed her mind and allegedly had two military police officers stationed outside her parents' home. One young woman was told that if she didn't go through with her enlistment, her family would be deported. Have you guys heard stories of threats like this? David?
Well, last year, I had an experience where a student at one of the high schools joined the DEP program. And it really broke my heart because he was one of the students who used to come to my table all the time and talk to me and real supportive. But they come from a poor community, Alviso, largely minority. And they told him that he was going to get $30,000, so he joined. And when I found out, when the other students told me he joined the National Guard, I was really disappointed. So I immediately went to the iCasualties.org website, and I printed out all the names of the National Guard that have died in Iraq. And I took that to the school, the whole list, and I gave it to him. And I said, "This is the National Guard who have died in Iraq." And his friends were looking at it and say, "His name is going to be on there." And I mean, they were really giving him a hard time because they disagreed with him doing that. But he eventually found out that he wasn't going to get that $30,000 up front. And it was the only reason why he had done that. And so he asked me to help him get out. And so I was so happy to be able to do that. And I said, all you got to do is tell them you don't want to come back and don't go. You don't have to show up. It's a non-binding contract. So that's what he did. He told his recruiter he wasn't interested anymore. And they said, well, if you're going to leave, then you have to come to and talk to my commanding officer. So, for like an exit interview. And I told him, look, they're going to sit you down and they're going to try their hardest to get you to stay in. I said, but you need to be strong and you need to stand your ground and say no. And he did it. So there was pressure put on him as far as telling him that he had to come in for this exit interview with the commanding officer, but he was strong enough to tell them, no, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Sandra?
We are one of the places where the GI Rights Hotline, the GI Rights Hotline is national, and there's 20 different locations where the calls are taken, and we're one of those places. So we get a lot of DEP calls. And we hear a lot of stories. There is a tremendous amount of pressure put on these kids. It's really important for them to know that that's kind of a standard line, that they have to go in and have an exit interview or just, some kind of a process. That's not true. They don't have to do that. What we say is that if you start to get a lot of pressure and you don't like it, you can always shut off your phone. Just don't take the calls. Sometimes a recruiter will call the parents. They don't have to take the calls. It's, the stories about the pressure on DEP cases are extraordinary. There are stories of kidnapping, really off-the-wall stuff. I tend to think that that is exceptional, but it is standard that there is extraordinary pressure on the kids to follow through with that contract, and they really need to know that they don't have to. And if there is abuse, there is a phone number. It's 1-877-688-6881 to report recruiter abuse. And what we're trying to do is document enough cases that there could be congressional hearings or
you know, media, you know, some way of continuing to bring light on this issue of recruiter abuse.
And we should mention that a lawsuit about 25 years ago guarantees counter-recruiters the same access to schools that military recruiters have. But David, I wanted to follow up with you. This work is pretty personal to you. What made you start doing counter-recruitment?
Well, back in May 20th, 1967, my oldest brother was killed in combat in Vietnam. He was 20 years old, drafted out of college into the Army, and less than a year later, he was dead. I was 13 years old, and I didn't talk about his death for 36 years until the Iraq War came about, and all these years later, I knew that I had to do something. Luckily, one of the schools that I do weekly counter-recruiting on is my brother's alma mater. So I'm very happy to be on campus there. And I have displays, I have handouts and things on my table. And one of the displays is a 20-inch by 30-inch enlarged picture of my brother in Vietnam. And when the students come up to the table, I say, "This is my brother. And that's what happened to him. And I don't want that to happen to you. And I don't want anybody you know that to happen to." So the students are very receptive to that image. They really are. I mean, that really hits them. It's not just any old photograph. That's my brother. And then they listen. And it's been a really good experience over the last 6 years to be going on the campuses and talking to the students and telling my story and letting them know basically that I care about them.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to a discussion on the new face of military recruiting and counter-recruiting, produced and moderated by Anna Sussman.
One of the things the Pentagon uses in youth recruitment is something called the Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies Database. It's a very long and complicated term for what seems to be a list of young people that they can identify for recruitment. So, can you tell us a little bit more about that list?
I guess they get all the information from, like, I guess schools, you know, your credit card while you're shopping, emailing, you know, internet, you know, when you sign up for Facebook or MySpace. They get all your information, then they will come up to you and or contact you by any way. And, you know, talk to you about, you know, military stuff. And, you know, you're wondering, like, wow, how did they get my information?
So can you describe the Bay Peace opt-out victory that you guys recently won here in Oakland?
What we've been working on for 2 years was trying to, like, stop jammers to get from getting youth information from our schools, SATs, PSATs. We've been working on, like, putting a opt-out form in our Oakland Unified School District registration form.
So now that opt-out form comes automatic with their school registration forms?
Yes, it comes right in their registration packet.
So, Sothi, why did you want to work on this? Why was it important to you? Why did you even care if some kids' names were on a list?
To help save a life. That's what mainly I'm thinking about, is to help save a life of another person.
It was really extraordinary. I mean, these guys put together a rally that brought in, I don't know, probably at least 1,000 youth from the Oakland. And it was spoken word. They put on a play. They did a military fashion show. They went to the school board and testified. You know, it was just really energizing. And I think it was also incredibly empowering of all of the youth that worked on this campaign, because they saw, you know, the fruits of their labor, and that the district actually passed the resolution.
Well, one of the things that might be mentioned is how they get in contact with these students in the first place. I mean, during the Bush administration, there was No Child Left Behind Act, and part of that No Child Left Behind Act was, if schools were going to receive federal money, they had to provide the contact information of every single student in the school, and that was mandatory. And the schools could refuse that money. They could refuse to hand over that information, but then they wouldn't get the funding. So I think that's extortion.
It seems like one of the big issues right now is the DREAM Act. What is it that people need to know about the DREAM Act? David?
What people need to know about the DREAM Act is that it is not only about education, that there is a military component to the DREAM Act. And a few years ago, when I first heard of the DREAM Act, I was curious. I thought this is a great issue, you know, providing education for immigrants. And when I began reading and doing my research, I saw that there was a military component. And I thought, my God, you know, this bipartisan legislation has actually found a way to encourage the Latino community to support military recruiting their own kids. And I couldn't believe it. And, you know, this is a very smart strategy on their part that, you know, we don't have a military draft in this country. They call it an all-volunteer army. It's really a poverty draft right now. There's a poverty draft in America where the largest concentration of people going into the military from poor and minority communities. That's where they're coming from. And so the DREAM Act has to be looked at in a deeper way.
Well, a lot of activists think a way to eliminate the poverty draft is to institute a universal draft, because then all Americans would be sending their children to war, and only then would you get real objection to militarism. Do you think a draft would be more fair?
I don't think so. I mean, my brother was drafted. You know, he was going to college, and he got drafted, and less than a year later, he was dead. So I have heard some activists say that we need the draft so that everybody, you know, kind of has a stake in the situation and will wake up to what's going on. If you take a look at during Vietnam, you know, George Bush is a perfect example. You know, he was coming up for the draft, so his father got him in the Air National Guard. And at that time, the Air National Guard was considered the champagne division of the National Guard, because you weren't going to Vietnam. So you were going to be stateside. So if you're rich and you're connected, you're not going to have the combat duty. You're not going to be going overseas and fighting. You're going to have some cushy little job somewhere stateside. So it's not going to be fair, and we shouldn't look at bringing back the draft as a solution.
And I'd like to add to the DREAM Act part of it is that we're talking about a huge number of potential recruits. It's like 2.1 million young Latino undocumented youth. I mean, they're not necessarily all Latino, but undocumented youth. And of those youth, the vast majority of them are not going to be able to get on the pathway to citizenship through going to college, because they don't have other kinds of support. So one of the things that happened in the years that the DREAM Act has been going along is that they've stripped out all of the things that were alternative ways for young people to be able to get on a pathway to citizenship. They took out the Pell Grants. They took out the community service. The bottom line of the DREAM Act is that we really want to support the dreamers who are working so hard for this opportunity, but we have to be really cognizant of the fact that the vast majority of kids are not, they're just, as David said, they're going to be prime targets for military recruitment, because it's the only way they'll have to get on a pathway to citizenship.
Salty, I wanted to ask you, as a high school student, what do you think is most effective in counter-recruitment?
Well, the people that I know, I always tell them, you know, are you going to listen to me, or are you going to listen to some random guy that came up to you that's from the military and telling you all this, you know, BS? And I would tell them, what if you don't make it out of there? You know, what if you get in combat the first or second day you get there? Go to college, you know, fight for your education.
Sandra mentioned something earlier about being on campus to provide information so that students can make a more informed decision. That's what it's about. I mean, I was in high school at the height of the Vietnam War, you know, 67 to 71, and there was a culture of peace on campus. At least what I'm trying to do now is to try to instill that culture, because these students are not going to hear this message anywhere else, believe me.
And Sandra, what do you find most effective in your work?
Well, everything that people have said, the young people are wonderful, and I think for the most part, their hearts are right there to be touched. And so having people there who care makes a big difference. But in addition, we have found that veteran stories are really effective. A lot of times people want current veterans, but, you know, we've also found that Vietnam veterans and, you know, older veterans are also have important stories to tell that youth really respond to. So I think that all of us have a role to play. You know, we can all be effective counter-recruiters. If we care about youth and we want to create a better society, there's a role for us to play. And the people who have children or young people in the military have a really important role to play. Gold Star families have an important role to play. Veterans have an important role to play. But it's for all of us to really look out for our young people.
Great. And I want to mention again that counter-recruiters are allowed the same access by law to schools that recruiters are allowed. What can listeners do to educate themselves and their children about youth recruitment? If there's something you could tell them, what would it be?
48% of the federal budget is Pentagon-related. What kind of future is there for our young people? There's a military future, and the American public needs to get really pissed off about that. In Washington, D.C., they're the ones that are controlling shots. The ones who are suffering are what I feel they consider the throwaway kids. They're just throwaways. They're troublemakers. They're not going to make anything out of themselves, so throw them in the military. Teach them some discipline. That's the wrong way to go about it. The best way to save our youth is to invest in them. And the best way to invest in them is not by raising taxes, is by using the money that we already have in this country and spending it on the Pentagon and cutting that budget so that we can provide for the needs of all our people.
My final thought is that there is always a way to opt out, you know, from the military, that you can always go online and you can always go to baypeace.org. We also have a opt-out form on there, so you can print it out and, you know, fill it out and send it into the address that is given on there. For teens and youth that are listening out there, like, imagine, you know, you losing your family off of this military stuff. Imagine, you know, imagine yourself losing a leg. Imagine yourself losing an arm or losing, you know, stepping on a mine that is from your own, you know, like teammates. You know, you accidentally step on a mine and, you know, you just kill yourself. Think about all the hard stuff that can happen, you know, before you even join. Take a second, take however long, and think about the bad, violent things that can happen.
I agree, and I also think that people should also realize that it's hard to live with yourself after you've participated in these acts of violence. And so, you know, we're seeing extraordinary rates of suicide of veterans, 18 a day. So, you know, there are lots and lots of ways that people need to think about this issue. If you're concerned, get involved. There's lots of ways to get involved. You can call me at the American Friends Service Committee, but get involved, because they have billions of dollars. We have hundreds of dollars. And yet the way we are effective is if we have people who work with us.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here and for sharing your thoughts and views. Sandra Schwartz from the American Friends Service Committee, David Ledesma from One Voice in San Jose, and Sokhti Se Chowmin from Bay Peace in Oakland. We will link to all of their websites from our website, radioproject.org. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from a conversation on the new face of military recruiting, moderated by guest producer Anna Sussman. To listen to a full-length version of this discussion, go to our website, radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartoloni, producer and online editor, Khan Pham, associate director, Carl Jogbandhan Singh, volunteer coordinator, Daphne Young, station relations, Rachel Kozlowski, Courtney Supple, and Shauna Ray are production interns, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Andrew Bevington, and Marie Choi, volunteers. And I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.